Welcome to the Two Daft Yanks Podcast, the independent soccer show bringing you opinionated English Premier League analysis. Here are your hosts, Chad Smith and Corey Chatelain.
This is the Two Daft Yanks Podcast. I am your host, Chad Smith, here with a special bonus pod for this week. You will be hearing myself and my co-host, Mr. Corey Chatelain, talk to the Arsenal Yankee, and that is Danny Carbacioun, the only American to ever score a goal for Arsenal, and he is here to talk to us about his book, The Arsenal Yankee, and it's a great book outlining his career and how he has moved into scouting since his playing career was over. So Danny is a great interview, and we hope you will enjoy it as well, and we will be back next week with our regularly scheduled daftness. So enjoy the interview, and we'll see you guys next week. We are very pleased to be joined on the Two Daft Yanks hotline by Danny Carbacioun, former Arsenal player and current Arsenal scout. Welcome to the show, Danny.
Thanks, guys. How's it going?
We are doing wonderful, and I can't speak for Corey, so.
Thanks for coming on, Danny. Being an Arsenal supporter, obviously, I'm excited.
Awesome, awesome. It's great to be here. Did I read that one of you guys is a Tottenham supporter as well?
Yeah, that's right? Chad.
That would be me.
All right, Chad. So I'll know where the tough questions are coming from.
Yeah, don't hold it against me, please. But we're excited to have Danny on the show because he has a book that's, I think, I'm not sure if it's already out. I know we were given an advanced copy to kind of look over, which we appreciate. And the name of the book is The Arsenal Yankee. And it's a book about Danny's, just his career from the United States to going over to England, playing for multiple clubs, and then ending up now where he's at as a scout for Arsenal. So tell us a little about the book, Danny.
Yeah, I mean, I moved over to England when I was 18 years old, and I got signed for Arsenal in 2003, so I was there during a pretty special time for the club, and I was always very aware of kind of what was going on around me, and realizing that I was, you know, getting to play with some pretty amazing players and pretty spectacular management as well. And after my career ended and I ended up moving back home, I was constantly getting inundated with the same questions from people asking, you know, what was your daily life like over there? What was it like training and playing with the Invincibles, making your debut? Like, what does an agent actually do? What are loan deals and all this? And I found myself kind of answering these same questions over and over, and I've always enjoyed writing, and when I started scouting, I had plenty of time kind of on my hands on flights and in hotels, so I started putting my thoughts down, and then several years later, ended up with kind of a story for myself, let a couple of friends read it, and that I should get it out, so I ended up finally getting it published this year.
That's great, and We'll talk more about how anyone out there who's interested in getting the book can get their hands on it. But I think just reading what I've read so far, I think it's great. It's a very honest and open account about your career and your activities over there in England. It's great also because you, in the beginning of the book, you point out, and I'm kind of paraphrasing here, I wrote this down, if you're looking to read a book about a world-class superstar, then I suggest you put this book down. And then you go on to say, if you want to know what it's like for 99% of the rest of the professionals, continue reading. And I think that's a great viewpoint to come from because, as you say, most of your professionals aren't handed to them on a silver platter. They don't have the skill to go out there and dominate and make millions of dollars. And the daily grind of a professional football player is very true and real.
Yeah, and that was one of the big things that I think I saw is so many players come through the youth system. So many players end up signing professional contracts. And I think there's a bit of it's not a misnomer, but the idea that when you say, oh yeah, I'm a professional footballer, that means that you're a professional, you know, sportsman in general, that means you're making $1 million a year and, you know, you're living the life and driving fast cars. For a majority of the people, as I mentioned in the book, it is, you know, hard work. You're not playing on TV. You're fighting for a chance to get into a first team, you know, and people can sign contracts at 17, 18 years old, you know, professional contracts at that age. And then in football, the reality is by the time a majority of those players are 21, 22 years old, they're either out of the game because of injury or they just unfortunately weren't good enough. You know, there's so many There's so many young players that have this dream of playing pro, but there's so limited number. There's such a limited number of spots that teams can actually occupy with these players. So it is very cutthroat. And yeah, as I said, I wanted to just kind of give the truth of what it's like for the other, you know, the other half. Because so many books are out there about David Beckham, Patrick Vieira, Steven Gerrard, Frank Lampard. They're all amazing books, and I read them all as well. But I also wanted to kind of write something that, you know, other people can really relate to as well.
Maybe expand a little more, Danny, on how were you spotted at Arsenal, you know, especially being an American, you know, as a teenager?
Yeah, so I was lucky. I was prepared, but I was lucky as well. I got called to a Adidas ESP camp, which is no longer a thing. They've gotten rid of it since, but it was basically a camp that was geared towards inviting all the best high school players in the country together in one spot for a week, and then bringing all the best college coaches into the fold as well, so they could watch these kids and essentially just get the best kids scholarships. And I was waitlisted for the event, and then I was called to 2 or 3 days before the actual event happened, and was told that if I could make it down to Wilmington, North Carolina, and I'm from Roanoke, Virginia, so if I could make it down to Wilmington, that I was, somebody had dropped out and that I could, you know, be a part of it. So I called my parents and asked them, my dad, if he'd take me down, and he agreed. So we drove down the coast, and I got lucky. I was put into a team where the two coaches were former Arsenal players, and they'd called the chief scout after a day or two of the camp, after we'd all been playing, and said that they thought they had a kid that was, that could do potentially go over there on trial and do well enough, So the Steve Rowley, who's the chief scout, who would eventually become my boss, flew over, watched me for a week, and then after the camp ended, called and invited me over on a 2-week trial. And I went for the 2 weeks, and I was going into my senior year of high school that year, and I've said this across a lot of podcasts, and it resonates in the book as well, but it was always a very important kind of facet of my life as well, just because I'd always had this kind of mentality that whatever I did, I wanted to do it as best as I could. So I kind of tackled my schoolwork as strongly as I did my soccer practice and training and all that stuff. So when I kind of did get this offer to go to Arsenal, after I'd gone on trial, I had to make this decision whether I wanted to go to Arsenal or, take up one of these amazing schools like Harvard, Yale, Stanford, Duke, UVA, on a full scholarship, which ended up being a lot harder of a decision than I thought it'd be. But I obviously ended up choosing Arsenal. And then, basically right after I graduated high school, I moved over to England and started my career.
Yes. And, another striking thing in the book that we try to talk about here, when players move to one country to another country, regardless of age, is that cultural adjustment. And you address that quite a bit in the book about how even though the United States and England obviously share a common language, mm-hmm. it was still a culture shock to you, and you had to adjust to living in England.
Yeah, and Steve told me when I came over, he said, your first year here is going to be very difficult, and we don't particularly expect you to just suddenly hit the field running and lighting everything up, So when I came over, I disregarded that just because I was like, I'm an 18-year-old kid. I'll be just fine. I'll be in a good environment, with great coaches, with great players. Like, I should be fine. And it did take me 6-7 months to really, get comfortable in the dressing room, get comfortable on the pitch and all that. I was also 18 years old, while all my friends had gone off to college and Facebook had just come out. So I'm seeing all my friends at college now, which wasn't a thing prior to that. Now people are sharing pictures and showing their new lives and how well they're doing in their college soccer teams. I was essentially feeling as if I'd forgotten how to play soccer for the first 6 or 7 months of my time over there. So it was definitely difficult. And then, of course, away from the actual pitches, like learning how to drive on the other side of the road. The first car I got was a manual as well. So dealing with the manual on the other side of the steering, on the other side of the car, just a bunch of different stuff. It rains a lot here in England. So getting accustomed to that, where I was very used to having four seasons back in Virginia. Just various different things and nuances, like cultural nuances as well, that were very different. As I said, like the language was certainly the same, although I'm sure you guys know not all, it's not easy to understand all Englishmen. But it definitely took some adjusting to. But once I was here and I was, once that time had kind of passed, I was ecstatic to be here. And even after my first season, that preseason, I was just buzzing to get back to start the next, preseason and get my second year going.
Yeah, and on the Englishman thing, I'm part Cajun, and it's kind of the same thing that just because, kind of like you alluded to, just because you can understand most of them doesn't mean you can understand all of them.
Yeah. I'll tell you what, parts of East London are very difficult. If you walk into a pub or anything, it's very difficult to understand some people over there.
Yeah. But I wanted to ask you another question, Danny, on something you kind of alluded to earlier as well about the youth players and, you know, how by the time they're 18, 20, or, you know, the 21, 22, they're out of the game. But before that, you know, a lot of times because of the limited spots, to see if guys can make it or not, they send players out on loan. So just from a player's perspective, what are some of the things that you can tell us that maybe go into deciding whether or not to go out on loan, or do clubs come in and ask clubs like Arsenal, you know, for a certain group of players, or you know, how does that work?
They will do. I mean, generally speaking, clubs will, you know, Championship clubs, even lower Premier League clubs, will come in, not direct competitors, obviously, but will come in and ask if a certain player's essentially services are available for 6 months or a year, depending on the player, depending on their situation. The club has to decide if it's the right move for the player. Ultimately, like, the player will be alerted as well that, you know, so-and-so club is in for you. And then, yeah, I think it's important when choosing a loan deal to know that the club you're going to, you obviously have a legitimate chance of, you know, being in the, like, essentially playing weekly. And nothing, there's never any guarantees. Like, no manager will say, like, I guarantee you'll play every week, because it's just silly. But yeah, you want to ensure that the place you're going, the manager plays a brand and style of, you know, style of football that you're accustomed to playing. So you go there and it's just not something completely different. And I was lucky in that regard. I went to Ipswich Town on loan during my second year at Arsenal, and Joe Royle was known to play a nice brand of soccer where he liked to keep the ball and pass and move. So the adjustment from Arsenal to Ipswich wasn't that big for me. Whereas when I did end up leaving and signed for Burnley, it was a very, very different, style of play. But yeah, loan deals they're also structured towards improving your weaknesses as well. So, a lot of people ask why Gideon, for example, Gideon Zalalem's went to Rangers, this year. And, it's been very good for him to learn how to deal with the physical side of the game. And that was one thing that a lot of people have said, he could work on. And I think there's no better place than the second division in Scotland to work on your strength and your power, because people will come in and try to wreck you there, and you have to be able to deal with it. So, loan deals they're great, and clubs definitely monitor. When players do go out on loan, the parent club will always be monitoring the player that is out on loan. It's not a situation where it's just send them out on loan and then that's it and it's over. It's send him out on loan, essentially have a scout watch him weekly to ensure that he's progressing the way he needs to progress. And then when the loan deal's over, bring him back and then reassess where they are within the club and whether or not, you know, he needs to go back out on loan, or if he can join straight back in with the first team, or if something else has to happen.
I think, Corey, I think he inadvertently answered one of our big questions that we had from the last, I guess, Youth World Cup. Did you catch the same thing that I'm catching on here?
About Gideon, or?
Yeah, the pronunciation of his name. Remember, we had the big row over here of, is it Zelalem or Zelalem or whatever.
Yeah.
So I think we have an answer from the guy who helped discover him.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's Gideon Zelalem.
Oh, see, right. So I lost that debate then. I was in the Zelalem camp.
I've heard that a lot as well. I can pronounce them outright, but every time I've heard people say it to me, it's always been that, but I can confirm if you guys would like and get back to you later.
No, that's okay. We'll trust you and your judgment there. But yeah, interesting to get into the scouting part. You talk about that in your book as well. And the big thing that jumped out to me is you say, once you went through kind of your crash course in scouting, you said that the two biggest things that scouts are looking for in terms of projecting what a player could become is their intelligence and their technique.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think those are the two things that we look for a lot. I was lucky from the scouting perspective. I was very lucky that I got the chance to play at Arsenal and got to play under Arsene Wenger and see what players came through the system, made it, those players that didn't make it, why they made it, why they didn't make it. And to me, kind of something that stuck out to all the guys that did make it were they were technically very, very good. And they're also very, very intelligent and kind of match intelligence and soccer intelligence. It comes across in multiple ways, knowing where you are on the pitch, knowing where your teammates are on the pitch, being able to play a weighted ball at the weight that it needs to be played at, making sure that you know which side of the person's body you need to play the ball on. Like all these little things that make the best players in the world. And at the highest levels, you see this more and more, and when you really break down, when you really, you know, go watch a player and break him down, and, you know, as a scout, I'll go watch games and watch one player for 90 minutes, or two players for 90 minutes, and I'm just strictly focused on them. You see it more and more, and I think these little things sometimes get lost in matches when, you know, there's 22 guys and you're there as a fan and you're trying to keep up with actually what's going on in the game and be able to talk about it afterwards and beforehand and all that stuff. When you go as a scout and you're actually watching essentially every single movement of a player, when he has the ball, when he doesn't have the ball, what he's like kind of mentally when his team go down a goal, what he's like away from home, what he's like at home. I think all these things help you paint a picture. But for me, the two huge things, obviously, are technical ability and intelligence. And if you don't have those, especially at Arsenal, then players will find it very difficult to handle the level there. Sure.
Yeah, and kind of the antithesis to that, Danny. What are some of the key parts of a scouting job that maybe the public at large may not be aware of, you know, maybe the less glamorous side of scouting, since there's this kind of idea that, oh, well, scouting must be all fun because all you do is go watch players and watch matches all the time.
Yeah, I'll say this. I had enough time to write a book during my time in the U.S. as a scout. So it's a very solitary lifestyle, I'll say that. I'm living in London now, so it's a little bit different. I'm covering Premier League and Championship games here, so it's a little different in that regard, which has actually been very, very refreshing for me, just because when I was fully focused on essentially all of CONCACAF, you know, two, three times a week I was getting on a flight and going somewhere in the U.S., Mexico, Canada, potentially Central America as well, looking at players. And it is very frustrating because it can be very frustrating, and then ultimately it can be very, very rewarding if something, you know, if you do find a player that the club do end up signing and it all works out. And for me, finding Gideon and Joel Campbell, those were, you know, two players in 8 years essentially of flying around almost 200,000 miles a year, you know, around the region looking for guys. And I think especially coming from actually having played soccer, where, you know, you go train and a lot of jobs are like this, where you see the results kind of immediately of what you're doing. And I've always kind of been, that's the type of person I am. That's the type of personality I have as well. Like I like to do stuff and then see the results and then decide whether I need to improve it or do something else to completely ditch what I tried and try something else. So, with scouting, I found that quite difficult because I'd go on a trip and, you know, 99% of the trips, I wouldn't say are useless. You don't particularly know about a player if you don't go and watch them. But actually getting to the point where the first, like, for example, the first time I saw Gideon and knowing, well, I think we've got a special player on our hands. And then having him finally sign. And then the first time I saw Joel Campbell, and then ultimately having him sign, like those are, I think those are moments that scouts cherish greatly just because they don't happen very often. And to go back to your question about what are some of the things that people don't know, I mean, I get asked all the time to bring players over on trial. I appreciate, I mean, building, like, one part, a huge part of scouting is obviously network building. and kind of building a network that you trust, or you can call. You know, I can't be everywhere, you know, at once, and there's a lot of games all over the region all the time. So calling agents, coaches, scouts, contacts just in general, and asking about the areas, asking them who's doing well and all this sort of stuff. And I started to notice, like, more and more people were saying, oh, yes, my, you know, you got to come watch my player. Like, he could comfortably play in Arsenal's reserve teams. And I'm like, okay, well, when was the last time you saw Arsenal's reserves play? And they're like, oh, well, I've never seen the reserves play, but, you know, I watched the first team play, and they're, you know, I could see him having a future there. And I'm like, well, it's hard to say, you know, a boy in Southern California who's accustomed to 75-degree weather every single day, and he's been playing with his friends all the time, and he's never seen the standard of what it's like playing in, like, for example, a reserve game in England, how somebody can just say, oh, yeah, he'd be easy to get him over there and get him on trial. So these were – I mean, these were kind of like the difficult things to kind of navigate through, and also when you bring a boy over on trial, you have to be essentially 150% sure that the club are going to sign him. Like, you have to be all in on the player. There's no way you can be on the fence and say, like, oh, let's just bring him in to see how he does. It's not that when you're a scout. If you do that enough, and you bring in players that aren't good enough, then you'll quickly find yourself unemployed and looking for the next team to scout for. So these are all the kind of the hard things. As what you said, a lot of people just say, oh, you're a scout, you just go watch soccer for a living, and that's it. That must be pretty awesome. Like, I can pick out a player too. But there is a lot more, I suppose, that goes into it.
No, it's interesting that you say that you – have since moved from scouting the CONCACAF region to now doing some more championship and EPL matches. So I'm interested in knowing, I guess, what is the nature of your assignment usually? Are you looking for ready-made talent that can come right in? Are you still looking for prospects? Perhaps you're doing some scouting of future opponents. What type of work do they have you doing?
Yeah, I've actually never done an opposition analysis, and it's there's guys that do that as well that that excel in that. It's not something that I'm completely disinterested in. I've just never been particularly asked to do it. I for the most part, I'm just told, basically given a target to go watch. And what's been really nice actually this year over here is that I've really only done senior games as well, and it's been an amazing experience, because the scouting culture in England is very deep, and it's been a part of the game for years and years. So just seeing how, and I knew how this is how it worked, obviously, from kind of trips that I've been over where I've been to watch games at other clubs, but doing it weekly has been very fun, just because you see the respect that clubs have for other clubs. You know, when for example, if you know, an Arsenal scout were going to a Chelsea game, for example, the club puts in a formal request for a scout ticket, and, you know, all the communication, it's funny, they're all rivals, but all the communication is very, very good, and everybody's taken care of, because ultimately they want their own scouts being taken care of as well when they go visit the opposition's grounds too. So in that regard, it's been educational. I'm given a target, go watch them, put a report in, and then wait for the next assignment, essentially.
Okay, thank you.
It's always an interesting thing, since, you know, the scouting side of the game is something that I'm always really interested in, and analysis and all that. So to hear somebody that's actually done it for a living and done it for a while is always interesting.
No, I appreciate it. I think the reason it's a bit of a, I don't even want to say a dark art, but it's so, like, secretive, is because for the most part it is a very secret industry, because nobody ever, well, at least if you're a good scout, nobody knows what games you're going to watch or who you're watching. You will see other scouts. That is one of the funny things, is you'll see other scouts at games, especially if there's a good young player that's doing very good things and in form, for example. You'll see kind of all the same guys every single week, different grounds around the country, and it is a very unique, funny culture. It's rude to ask, like, why you're there or who you're watching, you know. So the small talk before a game can be pretty hilarious, and usually all the scouts are sat in the same area as well. They have an area for scouts, so there'll be 10 or 15 guys, you know, with notepads and pens, kind of writing notes the entire game, and then they'll write a note and then cover their notepad, and then write a note and cover their notepad. So, it is interesting. But yeah, as I said, for the most part, I think that's why there isn't that much information out there, just because it is quite a secretive part of the football industry.
Well, with that said, that kind of generated a question. And again, you don't have to go into the specifics of it, but is there something like that to where, you know, maybe that goes into something, you know, in your report where, you know, hey, I've seen this guy four times. He might be on the same player. We might have to speed this process up, or you know, does that just kind of go? Not that it doesn't get, you know, taken into consideration, because you just mentioned that it, you know, that it does kind of make for interesting small talk before matches. But, you know, does something like that kind of go in sometimes to where it's like, well, you know, we either have to make a decision on this guy soon, or you know, does that not happen?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say it does. And I wouldn't say it goes into a report, but you'd, you know, after a game or something, you'd say, hey, I'd call my boss or whatever or send him a message and say, hey, I saw United and City there again this week, just to let you know. And at the end of the day, you have to just choose yourself if the club wants to act on the player. Obviously, with the pressure, when the pressure of other clubs comes in, it might make your decision have to be made a bit more hastily. But you'd like to think that part of the job is scouting is getting it done, you know, in time, or getting it done, you know, beforehand, so you're not rushed. But there are situations, obviously, if a kid's very young and he plays five games in a row, he's made his debut, plays five games in a row, and he's done very well, and all of a sudden he's garnering all this attention from across the country, then the reality is, yeah, you'll see the same guys over and over at games, and you just have to decide, you know, if he's right for your club or not.
Yeah, because I imagine in the information age, it's hard to, you know, I imagine it's hard to, you know, to keep, you know, a gem under wraps, so to speak.
Yeah, it's not a,
especially in the Twitter age.
Yeah, it's not easy. I mean, I remember the first kind of taste I got of it was this was about a year into my year or 2 years into my time as a scout in the U.S. I was actually tracking Brad Guzan for a while when he was at Chivas USA, and funny enough, Brad's a good friend of mine. So going out to LA and kind of watching him every other week was kind of hilarious. But in Toronto at a game, I guess I got recognized, and somebody tweeted about it. And then I was in the newspaper basically the next day saying Arsenal scout, you know, Andy Kerbossian was seen, or said feverishly writing notes, presumably on Brad Guzan.
it's like the message in Football Manager.
Yeah, exactly. and over here, I'd say the culture is slightly different over here. I mean, everybody always sees scouts at games. And I suppose if you're a season ticket holder for the club that you're, you know, the club that you support, and you always see, and you have a talented youngster or a talented player that you know is already getting attention, then seeing scouts, it's not like it's, you know, he'll probably end up going somewhere eventually, especially if it's a smaller Premier League side or Championship side. So it's not like, I mean, tweeting it and saying something, I don't think it would get any attention, just because people would be like, yeah, you know, no crap. Of course, scouts are there. He's a good player. So.
Right.
Oh, yeah, and this is a great conversation. Corey and I have been trying to get somebody in the scouting arena on, just so we could have a better idea of what actually goes behind the scenes. But to get back to your book, one of the things I like is in the end you have your glossary of English slang, which is great for everybody. So that alone is worth going and getting the book.
I'm glad to hear that. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I was going to say before it went to print, I nearly deleted that, actually, because I wrote that 5 years ago, and I was like, I don't know if this is okay or not, but I'll just leave it in there.
No, it's definitely okay. And if you revise the book, I don't know, this is my favorite word. I hear it on the radio a lot when I listen to UK radio, but I like the word nutter. It's a word I use a lot over here, and I get weird looks.
Yeah, it's a good one. Basically a bit of a crazy person, but yeah. It's used pretty freely over here.
Yeah, and I'm trying to bring it one use at a time into the American lexicon.
Absolutely. I think Men in Blazers have done a decent job of kind of educating people a little bit with some of the words that they use. But yeah, there's just an entire, and this goes back to culturally getting, you know, acclimated when you go to a different country. I mean, these are all English words, but I'd never heard any of them until I moved over here. And some of the words mean different things, you know, as you saw, like pants and trousers. You know, I'd always tell people, I'm like, oh, are you going to put your pants on? And that, you know, that has a completely different meaning here than pants back home. So, there are certain things, that are very interesting, I think.
Yes. Yeah, so, while we're wrapping up here, tell everybody out there where they can find the book. If we have piqued their interest in reading it.
Awesome. Yeah. So it's available now. If you go to thearsenalyankee.com, if you're in the US, then it's very, very easy to order, through there. You can, if you have a Kindle, you can actually go straight to Kindle from thearsenalyankee.com, but they are shipping now from there. So I'd really appreciate it.
Yes, and we will be sure to link that website on the blog post of this podcast so people have easy access.
Awesome.
So you don't have to race for your pen and paper to write that down. Any closing thoughts, Corey?
Not really, other than thanks a lot, Danny, for coming on. Again, I was excited to have you on, being an Arsenal supporter, and back in the day when I basically had to follow Arsenal online, you and Frankie C-Mac were somebody that I used to scour the web for reserve news. So to actually talk to you in person is kind of exciting. So thanks for coming on.
Awesome. No, I appreciate the support all these years. I mean, it's crazy, real quick to close out, it's crazy just how different times are now. It's like now you can get all the information about the under-16s if you want through Twitter. You know, someone's covering the under-16s, whereas – back then it was like if it wasn't on BigSoccer.com, then there was nothing existed on the player. So.
Yeah, I mean, I used to scour, you know, the basically GeoCity sites from overseas of you know, what amounted to fan sites, basically. You know, I forget the website now, but there was some guy that used to have an Arsenal reserve site that, like I said, I used to check that. I was probably one of about only three people in America that was checking this site.
That's awesome. Yeah, it's changed dramatically now.
Yeah, so when they put up the stories about signing you and Frankie, it's like, holy crap, we got Americans now. Like I said, it was pretty funny. And then when I saw how you got discovered, it's like, man, he's basically living the dream that I wanted to. Because I'm a little older, and I've actually been following Arsenal since about 89, 90.
Good time to start, huh?
Yeah, and actually the first time I ever heard about him was the Anfield, you know, winning the title in the last minute.
Yeah.
But yeah, I didn't become a full supporter till about 93, 94, whenever they signed Ian Wright. I forget the year.
Okay.
But yeah, so I was basically on the fence between Palace and Arsenal. So when Ian Wright went to Arsenal, it's like, well, there goes Palace. I guess I'll start supporting Arsenal. So
there you go. All it takes is one thing.
Yeah. But yeah, so thanks for coming on the show.
Absolutely. Thank you guys for having me.
Yes, thank you. And even coming from a Spurs supporter, you are welcome on the show anytime, even though you are the Arsenal Yankee.
Thank you guys so much. I appreciate it.
This has been the Two Daft Yanks podcast. If you like the show, be sure to find the Yanks at twodaftyanks.com or at @twodaftyanks on Twitter. There, you can stay up to date on all the Two Daft Yanks action by subscribing to the show.